Okay. I just can't with that music. Although, contrary to the opinions of many people, including the anonymous producer at ESPN who told my producer that he was shocked that it was the music chosen for Amina Khan's podcast, I think it fits me perfectly. In fact, a great mesh of personality and music, in my opinion. This is Bootleg with Mina Kimes. Thank you for coming back. This is week 2, and I have refrained from tweeting about it too much because I did not want to look clingy, but, you know, like texting a lot, come back, come back. But if you're back, if you're listening to this, that means that my playing it cool strategy worked and you're back because you liked the first episode or you subscribed and automatically downloaded it, which is kind of like when you hook up with someone and leave a scrunchie at their house or a watch. What do men do? Mike Golic Jr., what do men do? What's the scrunchie?
The guy version of that, usually for me, it's like a single sock because for some reason I tend to take one off at a time. So if you get one of my socks, I'm coming back for more. Which may or may not be a good thing.
Is off to a great start.
Horrible.
That's weird, a sock. I mean, a scrunchie's weird too, I guess.
If scrunchie's a little more normal.
I feel like a watch or like something, is it more normal? I guess in college, right, people would leave scrunchies or socks on the door to tell their roommate not to come in. So the male scrunchie is a sock, now that I think about it. So you're right, Mike. Anyway, thank you to everyone who subscribed and rated this podcast. If you leave a question, I've decided that in your rating, in your review rather, and it's not a negative review, then I will answer it. So I said that on Levitar, I'm going to stick with it. I noticed, so I was looking at some of the reviews. I said my mom was looking at them, but by my mom, I meant me late at night to try to validate myself. And somebody did ask a question. It was, I guess they had heard me say that I would answer them. So here it goes. This is going to end badly, but somebody asked if you could eat one cuisine for the rest of your life, what would it be? I guess American food, because I live in America and it would be the easiest. But if money and location was no object, I think I would choose Mexican. Korean is my favorite food, but like I've been Americanized by breakfast and Mexican breakfast is really good. Anyways, Dan Levitar did make fun of me for booking my friend Dominique Foxworth for the first episode. He said it was like bringing the local chef in for the opening or something. I don't know. But so instead of trying to book somebody famous, I don't know, like Drake or something, I doubled down on my strategy of bringing in friends. And so as you heard earlier, Mike Golic Jr. is here. What's up, Mike?
Hey, yeah. So two things. One, much better strategy. I'm way easier to book than Drake. But number two, also still trying to grapple with how I should feel that Dominique was chosen first.
Okay, so you're actually not easier to book. Well, then, yeah, I guess you are easier to book than Drake. But not than Dominique, because it is 7:30 a.m. here, which is why my voice sounds a little scratchy. I have this thing where in the early morning my voice sounds kind of scratchy. Anyone listen to the morning roast, my radio show will know this. Because of your schedule, Mike, no, I'm not complaining. I'm just saying, you know, for those who don't know, Mike Golic Jr. is on radio shows like, Golic and Wingo. He was on the Nickel Package podcast last year. And then he has a show called First and Last that's extremely early in the morning. So he keeps kind of a crazy schedule. And when we did Golic and Wingo together, you really saw me at my worst, by which I mean in the early morning, which for me is my darkest timeline.
It was interesting because leading up to it, for anyone that didn't hear you chronicling this on the Dan Levitard show, when you said yes to come do Golic and Wingo, which takes place from 6 to 10 a.m. Eastern every day, Monday through Friday, and did in that time slot when it was Mike and Mike, the show prior to that, and you, with your limited knowledge of ESPN, had no idea, so you blindly said yes and then asked me how long the show was and when it started and were appalled by both answers.
And there was one day where I forget what time it starts. See, I'm going to agree to do it again now and be like, yeah, it starts at 8 a.m. Like 6 a.m., right? I believe 6 a.m. Eastern time.
Yes, right? 6 a.m. Eastern.
I do remember. The first day that I did Golic and Wingo, my alarm didn't go off, which never happens to me, by the way. And so I woke up to a flurry of calls. I think Mike had to call my hotel room to wake me up and then sort of burst around the corner in your car. I came in, I think 20 minutes before the show started. They were trying to slap makeup on my face, you know, like just literally just whatever they could do to make me look presentable. And it was a bad day for me, Mike, because my, I don't want to say hero or idol, but I'll go with icon. Louis Riddick was in the studio that day. If you're listening, Louis, I know you are. You're a big fan of Bootleg with Mina Kimes, I'm sure. Now you know how I feel. So he was in the studio that, and if you're on Twitter, don't narc. He was in the studio that day, and I was so embarrassed, because I looked like crap.
Mina tried to do the nonchalant, like, arm up on the chair and then realized it didn't have an armrest. So she's in here trying to put on, because yes, Louis Riddick is somewhat of a hero to Mina Kimes. And if he's listening to this, I hope he's coming on the podcast soon. Like, he should be the next guest. The prophecy must be fulfilled.
I don't know if I'm ready.
I don't know if you are either, but you sometimes...
I don't know. I got to work up to that.
Yeah, exactly. This is a good build up. Like, you go Dominique to me, clearly a better guest than Dominique, eventually to Louis Riddick, who will surpass us both.
There's a lot of levels between you and Louis Riddick that I need to kill.
Oh my God.
Sorry. I gotta beat you down to build you up. It's podcasting 101. Look it up. So, for those who were here last week and didn't automatically subscribe, and this isn't the scrunchie you found in your room, you know, the way this works, we're gonna talk about some of the matchups that I'm excited about this weekend. I wanted to talk about the Bears, but they are on bye. I can't believe teams are already on bye, by the way. That's so weird. I know it happens every year, and I look at the schedule, and I'm like, oh, there's not a lot of games. NFL expert here. But I did want to ask you just really quickly about the Bears, or particularly Mitch Trubisky, Mike, because just when I was feeling good about not having to eat crow anymore on Josh Allen, suddenly 1,000 Bears fans showed up in my mentions serving me crow on Mitch Trubisky, which A, really flattered that you listened to the podcast and remembered that I criticized Mitch Trubisky. That's a win for me. So obviously he was incredible, although, you know, it is similar to the Allen thing, I think, in that there's some debate over, like, what percentage of that incredibleness we can assign to Mitch Trubisky. I went back and watched, Mitch Trubisky did make in a way that I think Josh Allen didn't, in that the blowout, the Bills win over the Vikings. Mitch Trubisky did make some difficult throws. It wasn't all wide open guys. But to me, Mike, the reason I think it's more likely to repeat itself than the Josh Allen performance is that he has the infrastructure around him. So he doesn't even have to be awesome for that Bears offense to be productive. He just has to be above average. And I think the early returns on that, at least based on this game, are pretty good.
Yeah, I think that's the key, right, is everything sets him up to succeed from the defense on through to the offense. They're like a Kansas City light when it comes to the offense, right? Like Trey Burton's sort of a watered-down Travis Kelce. All the receivers, you know, you've got Taylor Gabriel, who's sort of their version of Tyreek Hill. You could even throw Tariq Cohen, who had his breakout game, finally into that mold. And then you've got a top-five defense on top of that that's going to keep giving him the ball and keep giving him chances. Like, that's the big difference, too, is Patrick Mahomes, who we'll get to in a little bit, doesn't have the luxury of being able to rely on the defense as a young quarterback. Mitch Trubisky gets to come in a lot like the Ben Roethlisbergers and Tom Brady's of the world, rely on that defense kind of while he grows up.
I've always wanted to do like a ranking of who's the quarterback's best friend. Is it the offensive coordinator? The defense? Is it the running back? And it, you know, you obviously can't do a definitive ranking, right? I mean, it's case by case, but it is always interesting to me. And I remember when Russell Wilson was coming up, a lot of people would, you know, pin that on the defense and Marshawn Lynch, right? It was certainly wasn't on the offensive coordinator. Although these days I really miss Daryl Bevel. If you're listening, please come back. Really. I didn't mean anything I said.
I'm so sorry.
I miss you so, so much. But you're right about Mahomes. He doesn't have a top five defense. He doesn't have a top 10 defense. He doesn't have a top 20 defense. He doesn't have a top 25 defense to rely on. And obviously, that is the first game I want to talk about, Mike. That is Jags, Chiefs. I don't know if it's America's game, but I'm going to call it America's game. I don't know how you decide which game is America's game, but it's my game. This is such an exciting matchup for NFL fans. I'm talking, of course, about Blake Bortles versus the Chiefs defense. Just kidding. Patrick Mahomes against the Jags defense. It's like we'll talk about that because I actually think that's probably going to be the more determining matchup of the game, right? Is whether they get good Bortles or bad Bortles and what that means because of the aforementioned terribleness of the Chiefs defense. But Patrick Mahomes versus this Jags defense, which has been the best in the NFL, although I personally think you could throw the Bears in there, but by a lot of metrics they have, that's, you know, the Kaiju versus the Jaegers. That's just the best versus the best right now. Well, let's start with Mahomes first, right? He doesn't have weaknesses. I don't know. Like, I don't really know what to say based on Monday night after watching. It's like when someone shows up to a job interview and, you know, they're like, what's your fatal flaw? And they say, I work too hard, and you believe them. That's Patrick Mahomes. Like, I've watched him now a lot, and I can't identify a weakness. Can you?
I think the only perceived flaw is that he sounds like a young Ed Orgeron, and that's merely if that is not in line with your taste. Like, if you don't like that little bit of grit and gravel in your voice that lets you know you're kind of alive, like, Patrick Mahomes' voice is like the air in a casino. It's got that little bit of death in it that somehow lets you know you're alive. But I, you're right. Like, this kid so far through the early portion of his career has done nothing but light it up and take the small obstacles that have been presented to him. And this last week, I say small, that Denver pass rush, not a small obstacle for any other mere mortal. But for Mahomes, it was, all right, how do I adjust to them taking away my primary weapon in Travis Kelce a little more than I'm used to? How do I adjust to a little more pressure and break the pocket and make and have a record-setting day numbers-wise outside of the pocket? And he passed that with flying marks. So you're right, the Jags, and I think America's game is whatever game the Chiefs are playing in, right? Because we're kind of enamored with this guy and with this offense because they're lightning in a bottle. So the next test up, I think, is this Jags defense because they might be able to do some things that maybe come close to giving him an issue. I feel like that's the best we can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did a lot. I think we learned a lot about Mahomes in this Monday night game for the reasons you mentioned, which is by far the best defense he's faced to this point is Denver, right? And they did, the coverage was excellent in the first half and they completely shut down Travis Kelce. The defensive line was doing a lot of cool stuff, confusing the Chiefs offensive line, you know, disguising pressures, that kind of thing. And Mahomes was flushed out of the pocket a lot, which it turns out, it's like Aaron Rodgers, where the more you flush him out of the pocket, the stronger he becomes. He did have to, you saw him going through all of his reads, you go one, two, three, and guys were still covered a lot in the first half, but it was interesting to watch him do those things, right? It was like watching a cancer cell evolve, like metastasis. It was like watching you know, you watch Stranger Things, right? Like those Demogorgons when they are evolving in real time and it happens really on a compressed timeline. That's Patrick Mahomes right now. I can't name a so look, if being harassed and facing good coverage is a flaw in his game, then I guess that's the flaw in his game. He can do everything. The only thing he hadn't done until this point was, you know, we'd seen a lot of second halves where the Chiefs were so far ahead or fourth quarters, he was just kind of having to run down the clock. So now we know he can lead a come from behind victory. He can just, and when I don't want to put everything on him because it is the entire offense working together and, you know, Andy Reid certainly deserves credit as well, but he can throw deep. He's got the quick strike thing. He can play outside the pocket. He can step up inside the pocket. He can run, we learned last week. I mean, he can just kind of do anything. And this is really the most exciting possible matchup for me because this Jags defense, they've allowed just 4 touchdowns over the first 4 weeks. That's the least, it's obviously the least in the NFL. It's also the least in franchise history by all counting stat measures. They've been the best defense. It's a little bit early, and I think the Bears maybe have faced harder offenses. I don't know. I gotta look. But if there was a defense that could handle him, one would think it would be this one, which is why I actually think – well, first, I'm very curious to see how this pass defense handles the Chiefs, by the way. Tashaun Gibson and Barry Church, the safety duo, have been excellent in coverage so far this season. Ramsey, they play kind of like a modified man zone scheme. It's the sort of kind of a holdover of the Gus Bradley Seahawks thing, right? And I'm not sure that's the most effective way to handle Tyreek Hill. I'd like to see the cornerbacks actually play a little bit more aggressively than usual. But the key to me isn't really the secondary. It's just going to be whether or not Calais Campbell and company can just, you know, bother him all game. And if there is some defense that has the depth and talent to do that, I would assume it's Jacksonville.
Yeah, I think so. And I think what Jacksonville is sort of uniquely positioned to do up front that Denver didn't do a lot of, because you're right, like disguising coverages on this guy is going to be important. I think jostling his key targets, like we saw Denver very clearly trying to knock Travis Kelce off early on the line and get him frustrated, because if you got them out of rhythm near the line of scrimmage, that's clearly one of the primary targets in that offense. And Tyreek Hill is still becoming that number one. But I think when you try and get pressure on Mahomes, we're starting to learn you've got to do it diligently. Like, we always hear that you've got to maintain integrity of your rush lanes and stuff like that. But with the Mahomes and Aaron Rodgers, if you let them leak out of the pocket, you're screwed. And the one thing I think the Jags do different than the Broncos is they do stunt and twist a lot more. Like, they're trying to create some of those situations schematically where the Broncos were a straight rush team. And with two guys as good on the edge as Von Miller and Bradley Chubb, I don't blame you. But I think Jacksonville, what you can do with that is you can close the net a little bit more. So now where Patrick Mahomes will see space for a moment and maybe think he can leak out, it's replaced by a defensive tackle coming from the outside. It's replaced by a defensive end coming upfield. And they've got to keep him sort of like what we've seen stymie Dak Prescott a little bit, which is if you keep him bottled up and close the net around him in a pocket, any quarterback's going to have difficulty. But one that's used to being able to hold on and buy time like Mahomes, I think that could be the one way you might bother him into some throws and maybe even gasp a turnover at this point, which seems elusive.
And you saw that a lot in the Jets game, Mike. The a bevy of Jaguars defenders bringing pressure, and you mentioned, you know, there were a lot of stunts and they were doing a lot of tricky stuff, and I would expect to see a lot of that in this game as well with Patrick Mahomes. You mentioned we keep mentioning Rodgers, and I keep thinking of, you know, A Star Is Born is coming up. This week.
Do I ever?
I keep thinking of this scene where Bradley Cooper is like, he stops the car and he's like, "I just want to look at you." Another time to Lady Gaga, but in my now version, it's Aaron Rodgers and Patrick Mahomes Patrick Mahomes is the new, that analogy doesn't really make, you know, he's the new star.
He's a star. A Star Is Born. I was with you on that one. I was actually looking down at my phone and buying my tickets. I'm glad you reminded me. I'm willing to forsake Thursday Night Football.
I need to stay. Oh, man, that's going to be a ratings true challenge for Thursday Night Football. And we're talking about the Thursday night game at the end, by the way, as usual, Colts-Patriots. Listen, strength against strength is obviously the Chiefs offense versus the Jags defense. But to me, Blake Bortles is going to determine the outcome of this game, because this Chiefs defense, as I said earlier, is so bad. Okay, so they are allowing they're allowing 5.73 yards. So to put that in perspective, the best, you know, rusher, most efficient rusher in NFL history is a Chief, Jamaal Charles, 5.4. Jim Brown was 5.2. So, you know, the Chiefs are holding steady at 5.73. That's not great. Okay. And I've just given up on trying to predict who Blake Bortles is week to week. I don't, and anyone who thinks they can is lying to you. Just straight up. Because there's good Blake and there's bad Blake, and there's simply no way of knowing which guy's going to show up. And who do you think we get this week? Good Blake or bad Blake? After I just said that, if anyone who says that is lying.
I feel like there's only one version of anyone that shows up against the Chiefs defense you just talked about, right? Like, it's good whoever against that Chiefs defense. Because
good case.
Yeah, exactly. They got good case. They're going to get good Blake. Like, they're going to draw good anybody, which is terrifying and says a lot about that defense. But, like, who do they have personnel-wise? Like, you know, Marcus Peters left this offseason. Eric Berry's still on the sideline with that heel. Everything about the middle of that defense is open for business. And the one thing I think, Mina, you're with me. Scootability is something that we both value. And the one, like, hallmark of Blake Bortles, the one thing we know for sure he can do well is dude can scoot. So against this defense, I feel like that's at least in play.
Yeah, 100%. You know, and I think the other thing that we've seen so far this season is there's been a lot of conversation about the Jags' offensive scheming and whether or not they're, I don't want to say better or not better without Fournette, but maybe whether the scheme gets more aggressive or not. Whether Nathaniel Hackle, Nathaniel Hackett will keep his foot on the gas pedal as he did not in the AFC Championship. You know, against the Patriots, it was kind of cool to see him do the exact opposite. And I actually saw a little bit of that in the Jets game as well. You know, the Jaguars smushed them last week. But when the Jets started to come back in the fourth quarter, you know, they still had a big lead. But instead of just going back to that run, run, pass, they let Blake throw in that, you know, in the fourth quarter, and he rewarded them. And so to me, he is such a quarterback who, this is a bit of a cliche, but he does thrive when you instill that confidence in him. So I do agree this against this defense. I really hope they don't go conservative. That they, and I think, some of the things that Blake's good at, and at this offense, which is pretty creative, actually, sometimes, the things that they're good at, these little short outlet passes, you know, dumping it to the backs, I guess we'll get a lot of TJ Yeldon if Fournette's out. That stuff that's very effective against a Kansas City defense that can either stop the run or cover, but is especially weak up the middle. And they're weak everywhere.
Yeah,
to
no.
Be honest. I
was going to say, there's the no strength.
Yeah, I was going to say, the passer, Houston and D4, they looked pretty good in the first half and then completely dropped off in the second half. And so anyways, I do think that this game presents a really good opportunity for the Jags offense to step up and show that, you know, hey, the Chiefs, you really, guys, you think they're the second best team in the NFL with the worst offense? Because that's not how things work in football. I want to move on to the next game. Speaking of bad defenses, and sorry, I think I said offense. The Chiefs obviously do not have the worst offense in the NFL. They have the worst defense. But speaking of bad defenses, Mike, Falcons Steelers.
Oof.
What is wrong? Are both these teams screwed because of how bad their defenses are?
I think the Steelers definitely are, at least because the Steelers are kind of dealing with offensively what the Cowboys dealt with to a certain extent last year, right? When you take arguably the centerpiece of your whole offense out and then you're not really sure when it's coming back. And then when you come back, you've got the difficult part of integrating someone mid-season or at some weird point. Like, there's this weird amount of uncertainty there. Where at least with the Falcons offensively, this is a juggernaut of a group now that you've added Calvin Ridley. Like, as if Julio Jones wasn't enough of a weapon, Calvin Ridley's this route-running savant who's just been giving work through the early portion of the NFL season. I think 6 touchdowns already for him. You've got Tevin Coleman, who's this great off-speed pitch now that gets to be your full-time guy that Devonta Freeman's down with that knee injury. Like, this offense can really hum, and I know, rightly so, we're going to give some love to Matt Ryan and Sark in this process because they've been much maligned, but I feel like the Falcons are at least positioned more, despite the fact that the Steelers definitely have the easier division to work through in all of this.
Yeah, the Falcons' offense has been so good over the last year. Matt Ryan in particular, by any metric, has been phenomenal over the last 3 weeks. And it's interesting to me to see that some Falcons fans are still criticizing him and Sark. Like, if you're, okay, listen, I'm a Seahawks fan, so I will not accept any team complaining about their offensive coordinator at this point, much less an offensive coordinator who helped you score 11 consecutive touchdowns on red zone trips. Like, just put some respect on Sark's name, okay, so far this season. And I know that he was the punching bag last year, but, which I frankly thought was a little bit undeserved. I know he, you know, it was much more of like, if you have the, one of the best offenses of all time, which they did the prior year in 2016, obviously there's going to be a little bit of regression, from Shanahan once that whole thing came together, but they've been excellent so far this year. You're right. They've been more consistent than the Pittsburgh offense, which I was trying to think of a band where when you were watching them play, it's obvious everyone hates each other. Maybe like Oasis.
Oh, yeah.
Guns N' Roses hated each other, right? I'm trying to think of. I like Oasis because I like thinking of Ben Roethlisberger and Antonio Brown as the Gallagher brothers. But we need a band with like 3 people. Well, I guess Le'Veon's not there. Anyways, when you watch the Steelers off, it's so obvious that they hate each other. Right? I mean, how angry does Antonio Brown look every single game? And I get why he's, I mean, so part of their offense is predicated on Antonio Brown being double covered and bracketed and opening up the field for other guys. But it's also bracketed on Antonio Brown catching the ball. Okay. And him and Beth Roethlisberger seem like they're on completely different planets this season. The connection is not there. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that Ben Roethlisberger, I'm not sure he can throw deep anymore, or I don't know if can throw deep, but he certainly hasn't this season. And it does feel like, Mike, one of those things where, like, the Steelers are, like, one of those couples where when things are going good, they're really, really, really good, but they can't survive the fight.
No, and well, I think, too, you mentioning the group and the kind of discord there, I feel like this is like every friend group has that one friend that everybody kind of roasts. Like, you need that one person that everyone else can point to and kind of get their frustration out and who can take it. And I feel like that was Todd Haley for the Steelers, right? Like, there was just so much mutual dislike for Todd Haley on that offense. And he was Ben's mortal enemy from the time he stepped foot on the south side in Pittsburgh. And now that he's gone, everyone's looking around at each other like, wait a minute, I don't like you all that much either. And this is starting to leak over onto the field for them now. And then you have Le'Veon, the perfect straw to stir this drink. And it just, it's going to be interesting because I feel like the Steelers, and Mina, you had a front row seat to this, are very Seahawks-esque like that. Like, for so long, the winning and everything covered up the fact that you have a lot of big personalities that Mike Tomlin has allowed to flourish and allowed to be themselves. And when things go south, it really starts to look like it's careening off a cliff.
That's a really great comparison. The big personality is kind of the circus in the locker room, but as long as things are rolling, everything's fine. The second one of those wheels comes off, you find out that Percy Harvin got punched in the locker room right before. You know what I mean? And I agree with you. By the way, I just pulled up Ben Roethlisberger is 2 for 13 on 20-yard plus passes this year.
Oof.
So 15%. Last year he hit nearly 40%. So yeah, that is not great. He looks a little bit hurt to me, actually. I haven't seen, I don't know. Well,
that's like perpetual Ben Roethlisberger, too, right? Like, it's the running joke that, and it, you know what the difference is? If he was, he would have already let us know. At least we know that.
Completely. They only, got 47 yards in the second half of that Raven. And the Ravens' defense is very good, by the way, but they failed to convert 10 of 12 third downs. So that's not great. With the Steelers, like, we're taking for granted at this point that the defense is terrible, and at this point we're starting to notice that the offense might not be that great either. I think where those things play together, Mike, is in talking about this Le'Veon Bell situation and what they should do now and how we got to this point, you have to, at this point, acknowledge that the Steelers didn't plan for this at all. They knew Le'Veon Bell didn't want to play on a franchise tag, but they tagged him anyways, and that's money that they could have spent on bolstering this defense, right? That was just money sitting on the shelf. And we keep talking about the defense and how they have not solved the problems created by the absence of Ryan Shazier, and they didn't really try during the draft. They didn't try during free agency. There were a couple inside linebackers available, but this offense is so soft up the middle. And I think it's a little bit unfair. Like, it's not like the Ryan Shazier's grow on trees, and it's easier said than done to say, "Yeah, fix, you know, the middle of your defense and find a linebacker who can cover." And so I get that, but they really didn't do anything, Mike. And now as we look at this Bell thing, to me, the best outcome for them is to just actually let him come back and play out the rest of the season, because I don't think they're going to get enough in trade value to compensate for the loss of him. But it just feels like as much as Le'Veon maybe didn't act in the way that you would predict, the front office should have seen this coming.
Yeah, I guess that's the tough thing is, like, this reeks. So when you said that, I instantly thought of Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers. Like, if you've got this underpaid quarterback, you should be spending some of that money to fill in the spaces around him and give him weapons. And you didn't. So, of course, Aaron Rodgers isn't going to sit and take a hometown discount. And if you are going to leave money on the shelf, at least use it. Instead, it looks like you could have just re-signed Le'Veon Bell and at least had that linchpin in your offense, because listen, as good as James Conner's been through the early portion of the season, and, you know, based off the circumstances obviously surrounding him coming out of college, having to deal with the lymphoma and everything that comes with that, as much as he doesn't want to be known with it, it was a factor in his development as a back coming out physically. He's just not Le'Veon. Like, the way Le'Veon Bell bends a defense affects everything about this offense that's super lopsided right now. I think is dropping back to pass on like 73% of their offensive snaps. And then that in turn puts stress on a defense that can't handle it. Like, they're just a bad complementary football team right now. And I won't say Le'Veon fixes all of that, but he goes a long way towards at least getting you back to a baseline that's more comfortable. It's more close to the norm for a team that, I mean, Mina, you'd agree, has a pretty short window right now, considering the quarterback, what the long-term future is with Le'Veon and that offense. Like, it's closing with this current iteration of the team.
Yeah, and if there's one thing I've taken away from his absence, it's not that, well, Le'Veon Bell was the key to everything, and, you know, with the three Bs, we're always wondering which B is the most important. It's that they all need each other, not to be super, you know, kumbaya, new age about it. But, you know, I mentioned earlier that Antonio Brown, the way they use him is to open up the middle of the field. He opens up the middle of the field. Le'Veon opens up space for him. Ben Roethlisberger, you know, feeds it to them. So it does all work in tandem, and it you take out one piece and it all falls apart. Now, really quickly, just before we finish this game, the Falcons defense, I also think though the management there deserves some credit for not fixing the issues in that defense. Now, the injuries, they can't help. You know, they've lost the Keanu Neal and Deion Jones. So speaking of, you know, the spine of the defense being gone, that's, that's not their fault. But there are guys available. I mean, I never heard their name come up in Earl Thomas trade rumors. He would have been absolutely perfect for them. Eric Reed, I've said that I think the Panthers signed him as much to keep him away from the Saints and the Falcons as to use him, although he is useful to them. But they didn't come up there. my third eye just opened. So, look, they're better than the Chiefs. They looked a little bit better in the end of the last game against Cincinnati, which the team we'll talk about next. I think Tech McKinley is really emerging this season. By the way, what do you think of a t-shirt that says "He protect but also attack"?
Oh, Mina.
Did I do that right?
I think that's how it works.
No, I didn't do it right. Okay. I don't know. I regret that. Also, he doesn't protect, so it doesn't really work. I just wanted to attack.
Yeah. I was going
to
say, I feel he's like it's worth it for the punchline alone.
Way, and that's pretty clear.
Oh, yeah.
Which is me. Just my face. So if they, and I think Grady Jarrett is out this week, so it's going to hurt. But if they can, if Tack can continue to be disruptive, and that'll help Vic Beasley as well in the pass rush, that will compensate a little bit for the heavily diminished secondary. But much like the Steelers, I just look at this team and they're so unbalanced. And these two teams, which I really thought of as playoff contenders, I just don't see either of them making deep runs anymore. So that is sad. Before we get to the last three games, Dolphins, Bengals, Cowboys, Texans, and of course the Thursday night game, I just wanted to remind you guys, Bootleg with Mina Kimes, please leave a rating and a nice rating. Yeah. You know, I mean, you don't have to, but it would be cool if you did. And a nice review. If you put a question in the review, I will answer it in the way that I did at the beginning of this podcast. Also, if you think Mike Gold Jr. was better than Dominique Foxworth, please note that in a review as well so that I can text a screenshot to Dominique.
Let him know.
Mike, are you going to leave a lot of reviews now? Commission?
Oh, I'm going to spam the hell out of these reviews.
Just get all the Golics to... They're probably their Apple names, like, are their own names, so they'll have to create burner accounts to praise you.
God, that's going
to
be a sad state of affairs. I know the perfect Golic for the job.
So I choose the games, and... Yeah, clearly. I choose the games that I talk about on my own podcast. And the one I wanted to talk about with you was Dolphins-Bengals, because I think these are two teams that through... God, I can't believe we're already a quarter of the way through the season. But they're two teams through this early part of the season that you would kind of put in the pretenders or contenders group, right? Obviously, the Dolphins got smushed last week after starting 3-0, which probably led most of the free world to call them pretenders. The Bengals, who got out to a hot start, did pull it out over the Falcons, lost Tyler Eifert. We'll talk about that in a second. Also, though, potentially pretenders, potentially contenders in the AFC. I think these are both teams that are still marginal playoff contenders in my mind. So I guess I want to start with the Dolphins, Mike, because, like I said, anyone who watched that Patriots game saw them and said, oh, yep, that's the Dolphins. That's the team we thought they were, right? Not the team we saw through the first 3 weeks against a relatively easy slate. The Jets, the Raiders, and the Titans. The Titans actually looked pretty good, but that was that weird delay, weather delay game. So it was kind of like, who knows what's happening in that game. Anyways, we saw them against New England, and it was kind of a game that I think confirmed our priors for both teams. Do you think that they are as bad as the team we saw this Sunday, or do you think they're closer to the team we saw through the first 3 weeks?
I feel really bad, but I think they're as bad as the team we saw Sunday. Like, I watched that game on Sunday, and then my first thought when I knew we were going to talk about it was, I want to go back and watch the Raiders game, because the Raiders are a team that are really interesting to me. Mm. And the Dolphins, through like 3.5 quarters of that game, looked like the inferior team. Like, they were making that Raiders passing offense look like a juggernaut for most of the day. And that really concerned me. Like, the offense wasn't able to do much. As creative as Adam Gase is, when you're dealing with, you know, Albert Wilsons and Kenny Stills of the world, like, Mike Gesicki, I think, is a great piece. Adam Gase offenses have traditionally loved the tight end, and they've got an absolute freak show in Gesicki, the rookie out of Penn State. But the rest of that team, it just, they struggle to protect Ryan Tannehill. They have a couple of good rush ends, but for the most part, their defense has a lot of attack. Yeah, also attack. But it just seems to me injuries already kind of complicating things for them too. Like, an already changed offensive line, just lost their center in Daniel Kilgore for I think the season, if not at least for the foreseeable future. Like, I just don't think what they were doing was sustainable, especially as the schedule gets a little tougher for them now.
Yeah, I think I tweeted something before the game about how everyone shouldn't overlook this Dolphins secondary, and Xavien Howard was going to be a star, which basically locked down that he would have a terrible game and his secondary would struggle. Like, once I tweet something like that, I am sorry to you, your family, your future earnings. I have screwed you. Xavien Howard did get absolutely murdered in this game by Phil Dorsett, which, good lord, dude. They didn't have Rashad Jones, and that felt really obvious. Speaking of injuries, he was inactive against the Patriots. And so that was really obvious to me. You know, even as much as I like Mika Fitzpatrick, who had his first interception in this game, they need him. And I think the secondary should bounce back, although, as we'll talk about in a second, the Bengals offense has looked really good to me. But, you know, losing William Hayes, another guy that I thought could hurt them a lot, and I think it clearly did. Andrew Branch was hurt. I just think this was a team where a lot of their early season success was unsustainable when you start breaking it down, right? Like, I think they led the league in interceptions. Okay, for example. Things like that. Like, that, you know, things that are not, are likely to regress or not likely to continue. There were a lot of little metrics like that with this Dolphins team. That said, I don't think they're terrible, right? And as bad as Tannehill looked, and he was extremely inaccurate, he was getting hassled by a Patriots pass rush we'll talk about later that was suddenly hyper effective. I don't think that's what we saw on Sunday. That, you know, Tannehill's been better than that all season against, you know, not horrible defenses. And I don't think he's that bad, but I don't think, like, you look at this team from top to bottom in every unit and you don't see stars. You don't see, it's something that might be greater than the sum of the parts with Adam Gase, but I don't see many difference makers, I guess, maybe is a way to put it. I'm speaking a lot of cliches here, but so I tend to agree with you, Mike, that they're closer. I don't think they're as bad as the team that we saw get, you know, destroyed by the Patriots, but I certainly don't think they're as good. They might be one of the worst 3-0 teams in recent history. And I think they're worse than the Bengals, who are picking to win this game. If I had to choose one of these teams to be a playoff contender in the AFC, I would definitely go with Cincinnati right now, because they do have a lot of stars. And this offense, which, you know, they did lose Tyler Eifert, and when he went out, I felt not only a deep sadness for him and everything he's gone through injury-wise, like, poor guy, right? And you saw that in his face. It was absolutely brutal. But for the next two drives, you saw this Bengals offense suddenly return to the Bengals offense of the last 2 years. And it made me realize the ways in which Tyler Eifert really, really opens things up for Andy Dalton, who just, you know, he is an outlet for him. He draws attention away from AJ Green. There hasn't been anyone else who can do that in over the last couple of years at times. So I was concerned, but then, you know, they have this game winning drive. And in the fourth quarter, you saw Tyler Boyd and Tyler too emerge as that guy, and it gave me hope that, hey, maybe this Bengals offense, which has looked phenomenal for the first weeks, and a lot of that has to do with Bill Lazor, a lot of that has to do with an improved offensive line, which I'm sure you have been following closely, that looks a little bit closer to the 2015 line. That 2015 team was super stacked. But maybe this Bengals offense can continue to perform at this high level. Do you think that's possible without Eifert?
I think so, and Tyler Boyd's the interesting one. Like, it's so funny to watch him now finally start to feel comfortable in that role, because he was always going to be that sort of do-it-all guy in the middle. We've seen him in the past line up in the backfield. They move him around all over the place. He was a kid who went to Pitt, and I remember my rookie offseason training camp stint with the Steelers. They share a facility over on the south side, And it was when Tyler Boyd was an underclassman, but they'd be out there practicing and you would see Mike Tomlin and the Steelers coaches kind of just looking over there, ogling like they saw the new young hot thing on the block. And you just could kind of tell, like, you sit there and when you see a kid that you can clearly play, like, he's ready. Like, that kid was NFL ready. And his first year, that entire offense really took a step back. But now that everything's opened up and I think you've got a renewed AJ Green, Tyler becomes a really interesting wrinkle, especially right in the middle of a field where they like Croft at tight end. Like, he took a lot of snaps as Tyler was getting, Eifert, I should say, was getting back into the shape to play 35, 40 snaps a game. They've got some other options, but I think Boyd really fills that role well, in addition to Gio Bernard, who we saw have more of a game because Joe Mixon, was he nicked up this last game? I think that was something they were dealing with, like Joe Mixon, a guy who's come on the
scene. Yeah, he hasn't come back yet.
Yeah. So, you know, Gio Bernard is another guy that can help him.
Yeah, I think he might come back this week. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to say with Eifert out. With Eifert in, I would say this is the best set of weapons Andy has had since 2015. And that 2015 team, Bill Barnwell and I were talking about it this week. I was kind of looking at the depth chart, was bonkers. Like, it's so crazy now to think, oh, AJ Green, Mohamed Sanu, Marvin Jones, they were all on this team and they used to have one of the best offensive lines in football. And so when we look back at the 2015 season, in which this is the hill that I will die on. Andy Dalton was, if not the best, one of the best top three quarterbacks in the NFL that year. He was excellent. Okay. And he is a lot of people always kind of put him as that like perfect average, right? But he is to me the perfect example of how most NFL quarterbacks are context dependent. And if he's behind an offensive line that protects him, if he does have that outlet, if he does have, you know, a couple of great receiving options, he can be great. So I think for me this week, Mike, it's going to be that question of, okay, with Eifert out, with Boyd stepping up, you know, as the safety valve for him, can he keep that going? I think this defense, they did get lit up by, you know, Matt Ryan, but I think Matt Ryan and that Falcons offense are going to light a lot of teams up, and the cornerbacks had a bad day, Jackson and Kirkpatrick. I think they're better than that, how they played. But the defensive line is just so good that I really do think this is probably one of the more balanced teams in the AFC. And at this point, I think, and I want to hear what you think, I think that they should probably go to the playoffs.
Oh, I think they should absolutely be a playoff team. And in lieu of the dominant Steelers team that we're used to, like, if you're going to ask me right now, I think they could win this division. Like, I understand that the Ravens are going to have something to say about that. Yeah. And this Steelers team is going to get better. But like you said, this looks like the most balanced team right now. Offensively, we didn't even mention your guy, the pride of Washington himself, John Ross, who finally seems to be coming into form. Like, that to me is a huge difference maker in this offense, with a guy that can potentially, you know, we always use it, but take the top off, at the very least, give someone else a burner other than AJ Green to think about in that offense. Like, I think when we see these modern NFL offenses, they're all really layered, right? Like, they stretch you horizontally and vertically, but they've got people that dominate all levels, and this offense in particular seems to have that, and they've got their one supernova in AJ Green, who just seems like he came into this season kind of pissed off and wanting back in that great receiver conversation.
Yeah. I'm glad, first of all, speaking of burners, if any of the Goldicks are listening, when you leave the review, you know, make it positive and also ask a question, and I will answer it regardless of you losing your name. But I'm glad you mentioned AJ Green getting back in the conversation, because you're right. He's interesting to me, because I think at one point he was consistently in that Julio, you know, I guess Odell Beckham Jr., DeAndre Hopkins, whatever kind of top four or five debate. And he didn't fall out by any statistical measure, Antonio Brown, obviously, by any statistical measure, but he's such a quiet guy. You can't forget about him. And he was bad for a couple of years. So it is good. It's exciting to me, I guess. And I agree with you that he does absolutely belong in that conversation. It's kind of fun to see a return to form for the wide receiver, a team that could certainly, forget using AJ Green, could use any wide receiver, is the Dallas Cowboys. And this is a game I want to talk about as well. It's the battle for Texas? Is that what, it's Cowboys Texans. Do they have like a cute name for when they play each other? Like, we just had the Rams Chargers and people were calling it the battle for Los Angeles, which is hilarious because there are no, you know, fans of either team in Los Angeles. Really, the battle for Los Angeles is like the Raiders and the Niners, to be honest. But Cowboys Texans, I find it to be an interesting game, Mike, because it's two teams, in the same way that, like, okay, the Dolphins and Bengals, they're two teams where we're trying to decide if they're contenders or pretenders. The Cowboys and the Texans, to me, are two teams that kind of showed signs of life this last week. And I want to know if, like, between those teams, who do you think, like, which team do you think is more likely to continue that? Which team do you think that those sort of that resurgence, that 1 week resurgence, could be something real?
I look at the Texans and what they put together, because it seems to be in the last couple of games, all the pieces that we were worried about coming back from injury started to click, right? Like, finally, J.J. Watt in the last two games has, like, five sacks. He looks more like himself. Deshaun Watson and that offense are back to being creative around him again. And that was the one thing that we finally gave Bill O'Brien a little credit for, is they were moving pieces around. They were using option elements. They were getting him moving, because he's not well protected by that offensive line by any stretch, but he's got so many natural gifts as a playmaker, and you saw them all on display in the last game. So I feel more comfortable with that and the ridiculous receiving weapons he's got in Fuller and Hopkins. Whereas the Cowboys, like, yeah. I look at that offense, and as much success as it has, it's so predicated on everyone getting a win on their own. Like, no one's getting help getting open. No one's getting help evening or lightening the box look for Zeke Elliott and this offensive line. Like, you've got to go out there and physically win your matchup on that team, and specifically on that offense, if you want any chance of success. And in a league where we see so many offensive coordinators going out of their way to manipulate and help put their players in position to succeed, Scott Linehan's just kind of rolling the ball out and saying, you guys go do this.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. You know, first of all, J.J. Watt is all the way back, and that is wonderful. So far, through the first 4 weeks of the season, he's tied for first in sacks in the NFL amongst edge defenders, even though he had, like, a slow start, and which bodes well going forward. And Jadeveon Clowney had a really good game as well. And so, you know, this front seven, I think the secondary has a lot of issues, and that's going to be a problem. But if they're playing that well, and, you know, that's going to make things a lot easier for the backfield. The offense, however, now, as you mentioned, the biggest problem is the offensive line, and I don't see that getting fixed anytime soon, and that's going to create problems for them all season, and it certainly made life difficult for Deshaun Watson. But in this game, in this last game against the Colts, you saw Bill O'Brien go back to the scheme from Watson's rookie season when he had to redesign the playbook on the fly when he came in and burned down the league, okay? You saw him using him more as a runner. You saw him, you saw more play action. You saw more, you know, deception, using the run. And so, Watson threw a pick, and they kind of went back to the more conservative offense. My only hope is that they can just, you know, stick with the 2017 scheme, stick with what made Deshaun Watson great, stick with what led him to torch NFL defenses, because when he plays like that, even if, and that the offensive line wasn't good last year either, but it helps the entire offense. And I do think this defense is good enough to where which is to say, I agree with you that if they can sustain that, and if Watt and Clowney can continue playing at the level that they've been playing as of late, I think this team has a shot, of sort of turning things around. Now, the Cowboys offense also made some adjustments. Primarily, first, Dak Prescott was significantly more aggressive in this last game, and it really paid off. He threw it deep more. I think I believe it was PFF, put together some stats on how good he's been when he throws it deep, but how he never throws it deep, right? And so you want him to, I think, air it out a little bit more and be more aggressive. And you also saw them not only using Ezekiel Elliott more. He finally had more than 20 touches or whatever that number has been, but using him as a pass catcher. You know, the big play was, I think it was in the fourth quarter, was it? The third down he had, it was like a 34-yard pass.
Yep.
To Zeke. And let's see, where? No, no, pardon me. It was in the second quarter. Was it in the fourth quarter?
I think the fourth quarter is when you're talking about. There was a big long fourth down or third down conversion that had Zeke involved in it, and it did. It brought that element that has been sorely missing. Like, that's what great backs like Zeke in this league now afford you. The difference isn't that they're great runners. It's that they're great pass catchers, usually out of the backfield, too. Like, that tends to be what separates the Gurleys and the Elliotts and the Kareem Hunts and the Le'Veon Bells from everybody else.
Yep. Sorry, it was 2nd and 10 in the fourth quarter. You're right. And it was, they had him lined up in the slot, and, you know, he ran around up the sideline and easily beat the linebacker and basically did what you just described, what we've seen running backs do to linebackers this entire season. Zeke's been kind of interesting, Mike, because, you know, even in 2016, when he destroyed most running backs in the NFL in terms of counting stats, he only ranked 13th in receiving yards and 24th in receptions. It's just not, they just haven't used him that way in prior seasons, and they haven't always had to, but now I think what we're seeing is this offense has to use him that way because of the deficit of weapons for Dak Prescott. They need to start using him as a pass catcher and getting him, you know, moving in space and being more creative with him. And so hopefully this game was, I guess, I don't want to say a harbinger, but hopefully they did some things that they'll do again going forward. Which, again, I mentioned the Texans defense. This Cowboys offense hasn't been that bad either, to be honest. Going back and watching this game, Leighton Vander Esch, the rookie linebacker, he looked pretty good to me, playing in relief for Sean Lee. And, Jeff Heath struggled a bit, but the cornerbacks haven't been terrible. Byron Smith has been incredible. So if they can play that style of ball control offense that they like, if they can get Zeke as a pass catcher, if they can get Dak Prescott playing a little bit more aggressively, throwing it beyond the sticks, that's a great strategy in 2018, yeah. Coordinators, if you're listening, then I think they could be competitive. Am I crazy?
No, I think especially too, because DeMarcus Lawrence has certainly been the workhorse up front for them defensively, but we're getting to that point now, four games in, we get guys coming off suspensions, and one of the big ones for the Cowboys is going to be how do they reintegrate David Irving and all of the physical tools that this guy has that have been on the field inconsistently because of things that happened to him off the football field. You know, David Irving could be a guy that breaks open what this defensive front is capable of with those guys. Because you're right, you know, Vander Esch, certainly Jalen Smith finally looks like the guy that we saw at Notre Dame again, everything he dealt with injury-wise through the early portion of his career. So that defense is close. I would just like to see the offense do something creative with the limited weapons that they have piece-wise, because it's just so straightforward that you feel like unless the group up front, and we know it all begins and ends with their offensive line, that kind of patchwork group this year with Looney and a rookie and Connor Williams starting at left guard, like, you've got to do some things to at least get defenses off balance, because this ain't the group that's going to run up on people with Ronald Leary and Travis Frederick and Zach in the middle anymore. Like, it's not the same sort of look up front, so you've got to differentiate some, because I'm with you. You got to give that defense a chance to be great when it's got the pieces to do it.
I forgot, this is the week that all the guys start returning from suspensions. I think I saw a list somewhere that was like, they're back. Yeah. And I was like, some of these suspension, like, we can't really joke. You know,
yeah, a little problematic.
Yeah. I mean, I will be the first in line to make a joke about a weed suspension, but you know, they're not all weed suspensions. I want to finish up by talking about the Thursday night game. So if you listen to this on Friday or Saturday, I'm sorry, but we didn't put in the beginning. So, you know, you can thank me later. Well, I guess it is later. So you can thank me.
You can thank me now.
So this is the Patriots-Colts game, and I want to talk about the Patriots first, because, you know, earlier we talked about the Dolphins team and how in that Dolphins game from last week, you kind of saw the Dolphins look a little bit more like the Dolphins we expected. And you saw the Patriots, I think, looked a little bit more like the Patriots expected. How much of that Patriots defense? So to me, the biggest story of the game was the Patriots defense, because we'll talk about the Patriots offense in a little bit, and we'll talk about Brady and, Edelman is coming back. So that, and which is huge, I think, for him, and I'll get to that in a second. But this Patriots defense, I thought, looked like a completely different unit. Obviously getting Trey Flowers, the defensive end, and Patrick Chung, the safety back from their concussions helped tremendously. I saw some statistics that were absolutely insane here they are. When Trey Flowers, this is from Doug Kiet at NESN, when Trey Flowers is on the field, the Patriots defense holds offenses to 2.62 yards per carry, 4.86 yards per pass. When he's off the field, 4.86 yards per carry. It's more than 2 yards more, and then 6.2 yards per pass. So he's been such a difference maker for them. I don't think as much of a pass rusher, maybe as a run stopper last week, for example. He wasn't, you know, really getting to the quarterback, but everyone else was at that point. Do you think, like, the problems are fixed on this defense, or do you think it was kind of just the Dolphins are terrible and this was a one-week mirage?
I think it's a little bit of both. Like, this was going to get better. I mean, you know, they don't have, now that Matt Patricia left, a true defensive coordinator. Like, Brian Flores, who is their linebackers coach, I think is kind of overseeing it, but I don't think there's the official title. And there was going to be some growing pains. Like, Matt Patricia was uniquely adept at taking what Bill Belichick and this organization would feed him, which is a defense usually devoid of its most talented star that they would ship off somewhere else when it was time to pay him. And so I think Brian Flores and this group were kind of getting used to life without Patricia. And you saw some of those hallmarks, right? Very multiple fronts, a lot of movement to try and overcome the fact that the personnel-wise, they're not great up front. But they find a way to get it done. And you look at the most recent few years, this isn't the Patriots team Tom Brady came in. Like, these are middle-of-the-pack, back-end of the NFL defenses that are timely and bow up in the red zone and just give the offense enough of a chance. And when the offense starts to look like itself, and speaking of getting players back from suspension, step right up, human third down, Julian Edelman, it kind of has this pervasive effect on the rest of the team. They're sort of, you know, I forget who we talked about before, maybe it was the Dolphins, that just don't play great complementary football. The Patriots are usually the exact opposite.
Human third down. Would you rather be a human first down, a human second down, or a human third down?
Ooh, good question. I would go with human first down. I think we underrate how important first down is in a lot of this stuff and the overall drive factor. And I like to make a strong first impression.
I would just be whenever I watch NFL, like, okay, so I always think about, you know, like when a guy signals no catch or signals out of bounds with their arms, like a DB or a wide receiver. The thing I would love the most is signaling first down. Because I do that sometimes when I watch football games, like I'll point like in the direction of, which really doesn't go over well in bars, but I would also love when there's a fumble, you know, I'm not the most athletic person, not the fastest person, I'm not the strongest person, but I would absolutely always be the first person to signal that my team has the ball.
Oh, yeah.
No matter what's going on in there, I would be in front of the camera, we got it, like so quickly.
The swiftness.
You can count on me.
I have to, all right, two follow-ups to that then, is one, I have to say my favorite act to do would be to have the confidence of a defensive back who clearly gets beat, watches the wide receiver drop a pass, and then celebrates as if they were the one.
Oh,
like,
my God.
This is definitely meant to trigger Dominique Foxworth, who is listening late into the pod to hear me dominate him, but I'm sure that's something that he did at one point in time. And the other thing is, Mina, I have to ask, when you signal first down, are you the one to do it demonstratively like we see the majority of white NFL tight ends do, or are you like a soft one-finger Le'Veon Bell point?
Okay, so, well, I'll go with my bar behavior, which is sadly more like the white tight end move, where you get your legs into it, you know?
Oh, it's
you like kind of crouch a little bit and you go like, it's like the beginning of a fusion dance, the Dragon Ball Z, where you go kind of to the side, then arms all, you can't see me right now, but as I'm explaining to you, I am obviously doing it in my chair, showing the first down.
Celebration of the year, by the way, the fusion dance, right?
Oh, I mean,
my heart.
Be still. What was I going to say? I think that, like, we should do a video of how we would simulate the different, like, NFL players signaling things that have happened on the field. I think I would be really good at that.
I do
start a lot from my house too. But players don't really do that.
Yeah, no, not quite. I don't think defensive linemen are taunting the O linemen like, oh, look at you,
well,
tubby.
They just point. They just point at the person, right? So I could do that really well too, I think. Back to the Patriots. Yeah, Edelman back is everything. And I was thinking that watching Tom Brady because, you know, the stuff that he usually just feasts on, the little, you know, short passes up the middle, the crossers, he was kind of off. And some of that was on the receivers. Some of that was on him. I mean, yeah, it turns out Cordarrelle Patterson, not great still. But, which isn't to say that he was the guy on most of those routes, but he had like a weird, I don't remember if it was busted coverage or something, but he burned the Dolphins for.
Oh yeah, it was a super busted coverage. Cordarrelle Patterson's not getting that open on his own.
And it's like, if that happens to your defense, like if Cordarrelle Patterson, he's one of the like five players in the NFL where if he does that to you, just pack it in, guys. It's over. Tamon Austin is another one.
Oh yeah.
But, Brady's rhythm on the short stuff is so off. So even though they won and he had like the numbers wise a fine game, he looked off to me. His deep ball's been a little bit off all year as well, but I'll cut him a little bit of slack for that. So I think getting Edelman back is just going to be enormous. And when Josh Gordon starts to finally come online, the combination of those two receivers, I think should make a pretty big difference, for this offense, which apologies to Tarika, our producer, but I do expect them to beat this Colts defense, which, you know, has some exciting guys coming online. We all love Darius Leonard, the rookie linebacker. Marcus Hunt has been really good. But, like, come on. there.
I'm shutting the podcast down. We're done.
See, Mina, what we didn't even get to in all of that was the real reason they're going to win. And you heard me at the top of the draft this year. We did a draft show together on Twitter, gush about one person in particular. And that was Georgia Bulldog Isaiah Wynn, who unfortunately was injured during training camp and is my shining star and the one love of my life in this draft. But not far behind him was my little Sony Michelle, who is absolutely starting to supernova right now in this offense. Kid's going to be such a baller. I can't wait.
Yeah, absolutely. You kind of felt that breakout game with him because the Patriots offensive line has been fine. You know, they've been good all season, and I think the blocking has been there. But he struggled a little bit in his first game, and you had I think it was inevitable that this was going to happen, that him and White were going to have a breakout game, and I certainly think that pattern is going to continue against a, shall we say, porous Colts defense. I will say one positive thing about the Colts before we move on, which is that I'm not as worried about Andrew Luck as everyone else apparently is. Watching him, you can tell that the velocity isn't quite there. But I don't find it as concerning as, I guess, everyone else. Like, you know, he still can achieve the distance. It's just his ball's like a little bit of zip to me right now. His ball's like a little bit of zip. Take that one out of context, folks.
Yeah.
But, that was a good yeah, baby. but, you know, a lot of the way he's playing is by design in that Frank Reich offense, you know, which it does involve a lot of shorter passes, a lot of quick strike. He's getting the ball out much quicker. I think I haven't pulled up the latest, but before last week, I pulled up his time before throwing, and it was something like, it was in the top 5 or 6 of NFL quarterbacks. Anyone who's watched Andrew Luck when he was healthy knows that he usually ranks in the bottom 5 or 6 of quarterbacks in terms of holding onto the ball. So a lot of this is just the nature of the new offense. I think he is coming back online in a slow and orderly process, and I think he looks fast. He looks sufficiently mobile and physical, and the arm is going to catch up with the rest of his body soon.
Yeah, I think that the two things that let me know there was certainly that 40-plus yard pass to T.Y. down the sideline where we're kind of like, okay, he can fit it into, because that was, to me, the defining Andrew Luck trait was routes deep down the field, yep, breaking towards the sideline and fitting it in that like tight cover two window. Did that, check that box. And then there was a play down by the goal line in the fourth quarter when they were starting that comeback where he did sort of the Patrick Mahomes, like throw back across his body to the middle of the field in the red zone. That was like, all right, the concerns about the arm are fully overblown. This guy is going to be fine. We just need him to get up and start like pleasantly bleep talking his opponents again for me to really know this guy feels perfectly back to normal.
I love that Patrick Mahomes has played 4-5 NFL games and he already is like, oh yeah, that was the Patrick Mahomes. Like he already has signature plays and moves out of control. It's just absolutely out of control with him. By the way, T.Y. Hilton, you mentioned he is, I believe, going to be out in this game. So that's not great. Not great. I want to finish there because we're running out of time and I want to get to my only segment. I was going to say my favorite segment, but it's my only segment. So let's hear it, Stu Gotts.
And now it's time for Dinks and Dunks. I'm getting paid for this, right?
All right, Mike, you ready?
Was he eating when he said that? It sounded like he had chicken tenders in his mouth.
I don't even know when or where or why he did that, but I appreciate it, Stu Gotts. Thank you so much, and you're not getting paid. All right, question number one. How many times are you going to see A Star Is Born?
Ooh, I'm penciling it in for an easy 2 right now. Like, I was very seriously considering missing Thursday Night Football to go and just check out the early showing at 7 p.m. tomorrow night, but I'm going to wait. I'm going to do it on the weekend. I'm going to live right for the job, but I'm going at least 2 right now. It looks electric. What on-screen chemistry you can already see, right? Chill.
I've watched that trailer like 1,000 times. Now I'm thinking about the Rodgers-Mahomes thing, you know, like when Bradley Cooper play that song that I love so much. And then Patrick Mahomes gets dragged. He's like, no, no. And then Aaron Rodgers pulls him onto the stage. And then that very shocking voice comes out of Patrick Mahomes.
Oh yeah. You can say it. The young Ed Orgeron. Yeah.
I compared him to Ernest Goes to Camp, but Ed Orgeron is better.
Someone said
really
the Cookie
shocking.
Monster with a degree.
That's me, guys. I'm Elmo with a degree. Okay, Second question. So I recently saw a picture of you from your playing days. Your neck was about the size of my torso. Was there anything you miss about being that size?
I would say the instant respect on the sidewalk. To me, the most infuriating thing is when, because I believe in a sidewalk code of ethics where the smaller person gives the right of way to the larger person. And if I were to see, I don't know, the mountain from Game of Thrones walking down the sidewalk, I would swiftly get out of his way. And I just believe that I am, you know, owed that to an extent, but when I was that size, there was no question. Like, people got out of the way. I had a big beard, too. I had tattoos. Like, I looked like, and this sounds bad to say, but looking at me, I looked weirdly racist. And, like, anyone who knows me knows that's the furthest thing from the truth, but on just, like, purely, like, the Stugatz, like, based on physical appearance alone, I'm the guy you walk to the other side of the street when he's on the sidewalk.
How much do you weigh now?
Am
I allowed to ask that on a, is that HR violation?
Yeah, no, I think we're kosher because I still fall under the athletics realm to where that's like public domain, but I'm like 255 now, so I'm a good 50 pounds lighter.
Yeah, you're still, you know, you're over 2X me. We were talking about doing some shows together, and I kept sending Mike, this is for the listeners, pictures of Hodor and Bran from Game of Thrones, but yeah, isn't that...
It is the perfect visual of me and Mina like out in public somewhere, just me walking around mumbling one word and Mina just like on my back directing traffic.
Wearing like fur. Okay. For example, I mean, I get a lot of things wrong in the NFL lately. Right now, I was wrong about Josh Allen, then I was right about Josh Allen. I was wrong about Mitch Trubisky. Let's see if I'm wrong again. What's an NFL opinion that you were totally wrong about?
Oh, and this one is going to make our mutual friend and colleague Jason Fitz really happy because you were there with us. Again, we did a draft show on Twitter, and
I already know what you're going to say.
I mean, fully laughed in his face when the Raiders took Colton Miller out of UCLA with their first round pick. I mocked him. He was a guy whose college tape didn't stack up for me. A lot of athleticism. I didn't get it. He's been really good through the early portion of the season, like some penalty issues, but a lot of the technical flaws, like he really ironed out during camp and in an offensive line coached by he who must not be named that you are all too familiar with coming out of his days in Seattle. I don't even want to say it, but I did not
say his name. Say his name.
I actually forgot his name.
Tom Cable. I can't.
I was stalling as best I could trying to Stugatz my way out of this. No, I fully forgot his name.
I can't live in a world where Tom Cable is good. It's like it must be what it's like for Kanye fans right now, where it's just really disorienting. They're like, can I listen to the music? Like, I don't know. Everything I thought was up is down and right is left. And my belief system has been entirely shaken by this person. That's how I feel about Tom Cable having any modicum of success in Oakland. Like, it's so destabilizing to me as a human being that I'm trying to hold out that, you know, this whole thing is a mirage, but it's chilling.
Oh, it's haunting. I don't like it. The fact that you're right, because he got Rodney Hudson and a bunch of guys that were already good, but he's making Colton Miller look good in a way that I wasn't ready for, and I have to give credit where it's due, but I'm with you. I'm horrified and hoping the storm too shall pass.
Okay, question four. If you had, your name is Mike, you get a lot of people pointing out that that's also your, you know, your dad's name, you know, whatever. If you had to change your name, what would you change it to?
So, an interesting fact about me is that my confirmation name, so I was raised Catholic, and one of the things you go through is you confirm and like reaffirm your faith and all that stuff, and you have to pick a saint's name. And I was such a big Notre Dame fan growing up that at the time, one of my favorite players was a Notre Dame running back named Darius Walker. So my full name, confirmation name, is Michael Lewis Darius Golick. And so I would probably throw Darius out there. I feel like it's a good, strong name. Like, it feels kind of regal. And it's so far a departure from Mike, which my lazy parents, A, dad, vain as hell, going his name, and B, just picking the number one baby name for, like, 12 years running.
I like the idea of someone being told they have to pick a saint's name and being like, I don't know, Drew, Alvin,
Gerald? Teron
Armstead. Yeah. Okay. Last question. This is an easy one. Describe Lenny in one word. It's not an easy one, actually. It's very difficult because, you know, how can you compress so much personality, star power, vivaciousness, and intelligence into a single word? But please, I give you a lot of words there.
I think my one attempt, and the spelling is important here, it's G-A-W-D God. Like, his full given name in any sort of text exchange or reference is Lenny the God. And so I think that's the perfect amalgamation of all of those different words that you just brought up. He transcends. I will remember 2000. I just celebrated a birthday and I said, I will remember my 28th year on this earth as the year that I met Lenny the God.
Happy birthday, by the way. Thanks. Happy belated. Yeah. Mike, thank you so much for doing this. I'm not going to weigh in on whether you were better or worse than Dominique. I'm sure the listeners will. In the reviews, please leave a question as well. I promise, unless it's inappropriate or mentions Tom Cable, I promise I will answer it. I know you've got a plane to catch, but if you want to dance your way out to the bootleg theme song, I'm not going to stop you.
Run it back. Let's do this.